So I just went to log in and discovered a New York Times article that I hadn't seen. An ancient computer surprises scientists. I'm intrigued, but I will have to read this later, I guess. I think what would surprise me most of all is that it was a computer. I mean, I suspect it was some kind of mechanical device that probably wasn't programmable. So it probably wasn't what I would call a computer. So I think they're just using that headline just to catch my attention. But still, it worked. All right, welcome back, everybody. Any announcements, comments, questions before we dive in? Yes?
I was wondering, do you know what the dates for the vinyl?
So what I mentioned last time is that the best evidence that I was able to put together supported the idea that it was, the 20th is what I said. But I couldn't verify it. One of the things that I need help verifying is, when we have our class at this time here, what is the same class period on the other campus? I know that they don't start at the same times anymore, but I don't know what time this class corresponds to on the other campus. That would help figure out what the date of the final is, believe it or not. Do you know that?
Yeah, it's like 4:10.
This is our class. Oh.
The next class, ours is 3:20.
Right.
College Ave, it's 4:10.
That same class period?
Well, I don't know, but there's one at 4:10.
There's one at 4:10.
So an hour and 20 minutes.
I suspect it's the, well, okay, maybe.
I don't know.
I didn't think they staggered them quite that much. I thought it was more like 10 or 20 minutes, yeah. There is one, there seems to be a block that starts a half hour earlier. Like 2:50. So yeah, so I don't know. So presumably we're all supposed to be able to figure this out. The fact that none of us can figure it out is kind of sad.
It's not online.
It's, what's that?
I think it's
online. So the website that is supposed to have it, first of all, was down when I checked. Second of all, I went to Google and took a cached version, like just a copy of the old version of the page, and that one didn't list our class period. It listed other times, some of which were very similar to our class period. And that's why I just was left feeling like I wasn't really sure.
It might be from previous years.
It's like I got an old one. I think it had the year, though. I think it mostly made sense. But we can try it right now. So
they have them in the essentials.
In the what?
In the essentials. I don't know which one you
have. In the written schedule, the total handbook, they have finals for that.
Oh.
Are we in there?
No, I just mean like when the classes start.
Yeah, so does it list our time?
Oh, no, I don't know what the finals are.
No. Does it list our time, our start time of the class?
Yes. Bush is 3:20 and 4:40.
Right. So, okay. So the question is, what if it weren't on Bush?
College Ave is at 2:50 to 4:10.
There it is. All right. Good. That was what I was asking.
2:15 and 3:35.
Okay. Now you're throwing out more numbers, and it's just confusing me.
Well, I don't know which campus it's on. Maybe it's on
Douglas. That's another. Let me show you what it is that I'm talking about, and then maybe it'll become clear. So, how do we search for this? Like final examination time.
So that schedule doesn't tell you where the exam is, only when it is.
Oh, look at that! Ha!
No, this.
Oh, it's alive today. All right. So this is the thing. So if you look here, it says December 20th, Monday, Wednesday start 2:50 to 4:10. Is that us? We literally don't start at that time, but if this were College Ave, that would be the time that this class starts, right?
Yeah.
That's what you just said?
What's the things above it? What's all that? No, the first section.
Where it says Burnersville and stuff like that? That's just my web
writer. No. If you scroll back up, like, does that have anything to do with it?
All right, so here's the whole thing. So final exam schedule, fall 2006, that's correct. Then there's the dates of different possible finals. And Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, reading. This first block is not useful, right?
No.
So Monday classes, Tuesday classes, Wednesday classes, no classes. Then the finals start. First final is December 15th. Opening day of Aragon, it turns out. If anyone's looking forward to that, my son very much so.
Say nobody has classes?
So on Thursday, nobody has classes. It is reading period. Now, when I went to college, I had a week to read. Somehow they expect you to do all the studying that you have to do for all your classes in one 24-hour period if you don't sleep or eat. So I don't know exactly why they do that to you. But nevertheless, it starts all in earnest on Friday. That's not us. That's not us. That's not us. That's not us. I don't think. F start. Isn't that something on a camera?
F stop.
That's right. Thank you. Then there's some exams on Saturday.
Thank goodness that's not us. And then Monday,
right? So that this is not us. This is not us. That's not us. Monday, Wednesday start. That could be us, but the times are all wrong. Tuesday, no. Could be us, but the time's wrong. Physics, not Monday, Wednesday. Not Monday, Wednesday. This is Monday, Wednesday, and I think that's our start time. So I would say Wednesday, the 20th, noon to 3. There it is, in this room.
Why? Because the class starts in between that time?
No, because according to her book, when we have a class that starts at our class time on Bush, that same class period on the main campus, the College Ave campus, would be at this time.
How would we know that if we didn't know the time of the class on the other campus?
It's fifth period on this campus versus fifth period on that campus.
Here's the thing. What this should say is period 5. Then it would be unambiguous, because this is period 5. The fact that they wrote the time there means that they were trying to mess with our heads.
Maybe we're a computer science group M.
We're definitely not that. You're right. There is another thing, which is computer science group M. That's the enormous intro programming classes. And they all get together and have a block, have a great time. This is not us. I was confused by this, too. But this is us. This is us. This room, noon, Wednesday. Presumably eat first eat a little before you come so you don't, pass out. Not that the exam's gonna be quite that hard. It'll be this room, yeah. Go ahead. Sure. All right, anything else? That was definitely a concern, and I think now it's resolved to my satisfaction. I'm hoping that everybody else is satisfied as well. Okay. Woo-hoo. Moving on. You ever make up a question and then regret having made up a question? All right, so here's a quicker question. We're going to go through this one together. And then there's going to be one like it after this.
Oh,
sure.
Oh, you did a good job.
I did a really good job.
Did you write sideways a little bit?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A little tiny bit. Sorry.
It's all right. Ow. Sharp now.
I'm leaving.
All right. What we talked about last time was compression. And the idea of compression is representing the information that you're trying to represent just with fewer bits. And we talked particularly about Hamming codes. And what Hamming codes let you do is if you've got things that you want to represent, and there's some of the things you want to represent, there are more of them than others, more copies of them, then you want to represent them with fewer bits because they happen very often. The things that are rare, you can represent with more bits. And so I took a word. Does anybody know that word? Can anybody guess anything about that word based on how it looks? I mean, is it Welsh or Russian?
Hawaiian.
It's a Hawaiian word. It's a wine word for a particular trigger fish. And it was, for a while, the state fish of Hawaii, and then there was some kind of coup, and it ceased to be the state fish of Hawaii. Anyway, I can't write and look at it at the same time. Humu. Humu. Nukun.
Nukunuku.
Nuku, a pa'ua'a. They had a great time there on the Hawaiian Island. All right, so if we're going to represent this, if we're going to make up a Hamming code for this particular string, we need to know how many of each letter there's going to be, because we want the letters that are common to have shorter codes. So how many H's do we have in this strange word? There are two H's. There are some number of U's. Let's see. The H's. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 9 U's. This is one word. I'm going fishing. Hey, what did you catch? And then like a week later. Oh, those. All right, how many M's? 1, 2, 2 M's. How many N's? 1, 2. How many K's? 1, 2. How many A's? 1, 2, 3. And how many P's? 1. Okay, so this is the letter frequency for this particular word. All 21 letters of it. Now what we're going to do is build a Hamming code. And the way I stepped you through this last time, but not on the chalkboard, and so it's always easier to follow when it's done step by step on the chalkboard. So the first thing you do is you find the two letters that have the smallest counts. So definitely P is one of them, and we can choose any of these other guys. We'll choose H. So we take H and P, and we join them together in a tree, like so. The zero branch is one side and one branch is the other, and the total count here now is 3. I'll write it there. All right, so this P goes away, and the H goes away. All right, so now we've got 9 U's, 2 M's, 2 N's, 2 K's, 3 A's, and 3 of this thing, which is H and P together. We take the two smallest. What are the two smallest?
Two twos,
is that what you said? Two things that are twos? Yeah, so maybe M and K will do. All right, so we've got 2M and 2K, and we're going to join them together in a tree. Count 4, like so. M goes away, K goes away. All right, just move this one down. All right, now we take the two things with the smallest counts one more time. 2 and 3, which 3 do you want to take? No, actually, there's this too. Yeah, this counts as a 3, this counts as a 4. 2, 3, 9.
That's the A.
We can do the A, sure. All right, so we have the 3A and the 2N. We're going to join them together. There's 5 altogether. 2 plus 3, 0, 1, 0 branch, 1 branch. All right, now we've got this. We've got this group, which is a 3, this group, which is a 4, this one's a 5, and that one's a 9. If we take the two smallest, it's these two guys together, the 3 and the 4. So we join them together. They now have a total of 7. All right, now we've got a 5, a 7, and a 9. We take the two smallest and join them together. That's the 5 and the 7. 0 branch, 1 branch. Total of these is 12. We take the two smallest, which are the 12 and the 9. We join them together. Is it visible, actually?
No.
It is, but you have to stand right like this and just see the reflection off of the light there, which gives us a 21. All right, so that's our code tree. So what this is saying is that you is encoded by 0. N is encoded by what? Let's see how this goes. We have to follow the 1 branch, and then the 0 branch, and then the 0 branch. So,
no,
1 branch.
I can't understand it now.
Because of the top part?
Yeah.
They don't have black
yeah.
paper? No. All right.
Just
the whole thing had been lower, we'd be happy.
Tilt the top triangle.
Work off it on the chalkboard.
Didn't do quite what I expected, sorry. So I'm just copying that tree down so it becomes visible.
You said 9 plus 12?
9 plus 12. Okay, that's the tree that I was trying to draw. All right, so here's what I'm doing now. All the letters at the bottom are the things that we have codes for. We have code for U, for N, for A, for M, for K, for H, for P. The reason you get so many repeats in Hawaiian, by the way, is they only have a very small number of sounds in their language. Like, there's no S sound in Hawaiian. So to say a word like, does anybody know this? To say Merry Christmas in Hawaiian, there's no R sound. There's no S sound. And that really messes up trying to say Merry Christmas, because it's got the ers in Merry and Christmas. It's got the Christmas, it's got two S's in it. So instead they say, has anyone ever heard this? There's a song like this, but I happen to have been, the one time I was in Hawaii was over December, so I know this. Okay. Meli kilikumaka. If you just take Merry Christmas and you swap out the letters that you can't say and replace them with the closest thing you've got in Hawaiian, L's become R. No, wait, sorry. R's become L's, S's become K's, and you get Merry becomes Mele, Christmas becomes Kalikumaka. Because you're not allowed to have two consonants in a row also in Hawaiian. Anyway. So here are the letters that we've got. What is the code for U? If you follow the tree down from the root, from the top, it's zero. Just zero by itself is the code for U. Very short, and why? Because there's like a zillion U's in that word. What about N? N is 100. A is 101. M is 1100. K is 1101. H 1110. And P 1111. Okay? Did you get that?
No.
Was that a no?
Yes.
Yes? Yes, that was a no, or no, that was a yes?
Yes, that was a no.
Okay. So you want to know how I got like the code for M?
Yeah, do the code for M.
We'll do M. Okay. So because this is a tree, this is a property of all trees. There's only one way to get from the root to any leaf. So this M, here's the path I'm going to use with that the other woman did, right at the side of the chalk. This is that path. We're going to name M, the code that we're going to name M is exactly the labels on these edges. 1100, and then we get to M.
Okay.
So it's basically, you can think of it almost as being like directions. If I say, for example, 01, where does that take you?
01.
Yeah.
Oh, but where would you, but there's no 0 at the top, you're supposed to start the other 0, that puts you at
20. Oh, sorry, I'm sorry. Let me try that again. 10 is what I meant to say.
10?
No, because 1N is 100. Okay, let me try one more time. 101 is what I meant to say the other two times.
Oh, I'm like, okay, 1A.
Yeah, see, that was easy. What took you so long?
Because you weren't giving it up.
I know. I'm sorry. That was really dumb of me. Good. So you got it. I was just having trouble saying the right thing.
Okay.
So, right, it's just telling you what turns do I have to make starting from the root to get down to the letters.
Okay.
And because each of the branches had the two different labels have two different names, all these codes are unique, right? You can't get the same code two different ways because there's only one path to get from the root to any of the leaves. They're all going to have different names. Okay? So, that being said, I'm going to hide half of this. Yes. All right. So, build the Hamming code for Huma Huma Nuka Nuka Apa'ua. How many bits are in the code for U? When all is said and done. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Let me start to pick the thing going.
Oh,
Huffman code. Huffman code. Not Hamming code. And my cell phone is still missing. No, it's in, I swear, it's on a New Jersey Transit train, probably in Hoboken. That's my theory, yeah. The good news is my head is actually attached to my body, and so that's not lost yet.
We should figure out the running time it would take for you to go around calling your phone to actually find it in various patterns.
Well, I wouldn't. I'd have to be in the right place, right?
Right, that's what it is.
All right, I'm going to stop at the 1 minute mark. 3, 2, 1. All right, now presumably because we step through this together, everybody will get it right. Almost everybody will get it right. So the answer for you is it's a 1-bit code. You can still see it on the board. In this code, you end up getting a 1-bit code, which is 0. All right. So any questions about that? Most people followed that arc. All right, so if you have a piece of scrap paper, we're gonna do another one like that. See how that goes. Here's an actual English word, one of the ones I wrote again. And again, it's a Huffman code, not a Hamming code. That was another mistake on my part. But this is one of the words in English that has the most, the highest average of length to the number of actual unique letters in it. It's like 2.5 or 2.3 or something like that.
It's gonna take some time.
Remorselessness. Yeah? I don't know. I'll do it behind this curtain and see how long it takes me. Yeah. It's the same thing we just did for the oopa oopa ma wa wa.
Yeah, but we're new to this.
demonstrating remorselessness. Making a way to do this.
What's
that?
You might necessarily need to do the whole thing on that.
I think you do.
Well, the last one. You could have seen that there are more U's
in the sum of everything is zero.
Well, not the sum of everything, but the sum of everything is minus one. Mm.
Not
yeah, the same condition is not true here.
Yeah. It's just different results. But you can get it, I guess. I'm gonna pull the plug, unless you feel like you're close. I'm gonna pull the plug in 5 seconds. You can click it. Click it would be good.
Okay, sorry.
No problem. Alright, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Alrighty. So. Alright, so here's what I did. I took the word remorselessness. People know what remorselessness means, right? Like the state of not feeling sorry for anybody for making them do annoying problems. So I wrote down the word remorselessness, and I counted up how many times each letter appeared. 2 R's, 4 E's, 1 M, 1 O, 1 L, 4 S's, and 1 N. Anybody disagree with that?
It's a bad
L.
It's 5 S's.
It's 5 S's.
Remorselessness. Yes. Okay, so I made a mistake. Alright. Then so let's fix that then. 2 R's, 4 E's, 1 M, 1 O, 1 L, 5 S's, 1 N. Alright, then took the two smallest. Merge them together. So, I don't know, O and M, say. There's going to be multiple ways of getting codes here, by the way. That has a count of 2. All right, take the two smallest that are left. L and N are both 1's, so we can join them together. The count of 2. L and N are gone. All right, what are the two smallest now? There's a 2N. Oh, that's an R. 2R. This is a 2 and this is a 2. I could merge any of them. I'll take these 2. For a total of 4. Alright. Now we've got a 2, a 4, a 5, and a 4. So the two smallest will be a 2 and a 4. So we'll merge the R together with this guy for a total of 6. That one's gone. Now we've got a 5, a 6, and a 4. The smallest one merges the 4 and the 5.
Why did I merge the 2 together to get 4?
Where's
the rest of them? Like, there's, at the bottom edge of the tree, you have the O-M-L-N. Where's all the other ones?
Don't you have to do all of them before you...
All of what? All
like,
the letters?
Like, don't you have to take all the letters and make the bottom part of the tree before you work your way up?
Yeah, I was kind of doing that piecemeal. I mean, I could do like R-L-E-S-M-N-O, like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Weren't you doing that in the beginning, though?
Oh, see, yeah, that's how you started off, so I thought you would do the same thing, too. Like, make all the little trees first and then merge them.
But that's what I'm... That's...
Can you do it that way, though?
You have to merge the two things that have the smallest counts. If they're trees that are already there, you merge them. But if they're things that are over here, you need to bring them in. So you always take the two smallest. If you don't take the two smallest, you can get the wrong answer.
Right.
But sometimes there's multiple things that are the smallest, because there's ties. In which case, you're free to choose any of them. As long as it's two of the smallest.
Why didn't you merge E and R into a separate tree as well, when you connected it to the whole tree, like you did the other one?
Why didn't I merge E and... Because... All right, so let's go back one step. So we had R with a count of two, and the tree looked like this. So you're asking, what should we do at this step? Is that a fair question?
I did four, and two, R and E.
You can merge R and E next, too. Yeah, so you have the next merge we're doing has to involve the R, because that's the absolute smallest that we've got at the moment. But we can merge it with this, because there's four of those, or we can merge it with this, because there's four of those.
Doesn't matter, though.
It doesn't matter. You're going to get a different code, but they're both going to be optimal. They're both gonna give you the same encoding, essentially. Yeah.
Okay, so you can do the two small trees with the two R's and the four E's, connect that.
Yeah, so we'll do, sure, let's do that. We'll put R and E together, and that has a count of six. And then these guys get crossed out, like so. That's fine.
Yeah, and you can connect that to the big tree, or you can do each one separate, right?
No,
we can either put the R onto this tree, or we can put the E and the R together.
Oh, okay. Right.
That's one step. Now, then the next step, now we've got a 6, a 4, and a 5. So the two smallest ones are the 4 and the 5.
Wait, I have a quick question.
Yes?
When you connect the R and the E to that big tree...
Which we haven't yet.
Okay.
In fact, we're not going to.
You're not? Well, let's say you do, though. The one over there gets stuck in, like, the... In the middle. That's what I did, and that's how.
Yeah, if the problem, right? So if you don't bring things in piecemeal, yeah, right. You might have to redraw the tree every once in a while because things get tangled. Yeah.
Okay.
It's still clear what you need to do, but you could, right? You could have somebody that's kind of stuck in the middle, so then you have to basically erase it and put it someplace else. In a computer, that's not a problem because it's not actually working on a chalkboard. It actually is just—it's all pointers to things, so it's not a problem. Okay. But yeah, on paper, it's a bit of an irritant. Was that a question that you had?
Yeah. I didn't know to put the two down. Like, okay, my graph first looks like that button to connect the two twos together.
Uh-huh.
So my next thing, I have a 5 left. So I put a 5 and a 2 together, like the S, and then one of the other little trees together.
So there should never, in this particular example, you should never have a 5 and a 2 that get merged in one of the steps. Because there's always fours and things that come up before that. So you skipped a step, or you didn't take two things that were the smallest at one point when you should have. The two should have gotten merged into something else before you ever dealt with the 5. We can step it through, but there's a couple different ways you can get to a point like this. Here's an observation that I made last night when I was doing a bunch of these to try to understand how to ask a question about it. Look at the original counts. We have a 5, a 4, a 2, another 2, and 4 ones. If you ignore the trees for a second, here the order in which the merges will happen is always the same. There are no choices. In this case, you're going to merge two ones together, make it a 2. Then you're going to merge two ones together, make it a 2. Then you're going to merge two twos together and make it a 4. Then you're going to merge two twos together, make it another 4. No, that's a total lie. What the hell did I do? Because that's not what happened at all.
Four after
that. Hang on a second. So either I was just playing wrong, or I just screwed up again. Now, given my track record today, I'm going to go with probably I just screwed up again.
There's
two twos.
There's no
two
twos.
That's not
so.
There's only one.
You have two R written twice. Yeah.
Thank you. That's a good catch. All right. So really, the original list looks like that. Good. So we take the two ones are going to get merged to be a two. Two ones are going to be merged to be a two. Two twos are going to be merged to get a four. Then a four and a two is going to be merged to get a six. Then the four and the five are going to be merged to get a nine. Then the nine and the six are going to be merged to get a 15.
Why?
Oh, you're
right. That's all that's left. Okay. Those are the two smallest. Yeah. At the end, there's no two smallest because there's only one left, so you know you're done. So when there's a tie, there's different things that you can combine, but the numbers are always going to be combined in exactly the same order. So the next step here, we've got a 4, a 5, and a 6. We have to merge the 4 and the 5, which is going to look like something. There's a couple ways to do it, but one of them looks like that. Now we've got a 9 and a 6. The last merge looks like that. And there we've got our code. So the question was, how long is S's code in this example? And the answer is 2. The code, the way I drew it was 00, you could have gotten a different code, but if you did it right, it should be 2. There are differences that you could get for some of the smaller ones, like I think N could be either 4 or 3. So the reason I asked in the multiple choice question about S is because no matter how you do the merges, S in this example will always come out to be 2 bits. Yeah?
Okay, by bit, do you mean like placeholders, like you actually two placeholders, or?
So what's the code? So what are the codes for everybody now? Just like we did before. So S is 00, because the path on the root is 00. Then we've got 0100 for O.
So for that one, for O, would it be 4 bits?
O is 4 bits, that's correct.
Okay, so just how many digits there are.
How many bits, we call them bits. Short.
Yeah, I was making sure. I mean, I got that right, but I just wasn't sure.
Exactly. All right. M is also 40101. L is 0110. N is 0111. R is 10, and E is 11. You with me? I think so. Except for those who are too embarrassed to admit that they're not with me. You with me? Yeah, you're right? Okay. All right, so that being said, let's find out how things went. So the right answer was B, and that was the majority answer in the class, though it did kind of fall off on both ends. I figured that one thing, A, choice A was 1 bit, and because S was the most frequent letter, you'd think it would be a small number of bits, but it's not necessarily one. In this case, it ended up being 2. And nobody picked 4 or 5 bits, which I guess is good. All right? I think some confusions or possible numerical errors are straightened out now, so I think we're cool. Any other questions on that? I'm done with those for today. You glad? Is that what that is? Yeah. That's all right. I accept that. Good. See, actually, I'm not very good at having remorselessness. All right, so this is, I guess, a similar kind of example. So let's say we've already gotten the code. In particular, we're encoding C, G, T, and A, which is what you'd get if you were encoding B and A sequences. But that's not important right now. What's important is there are 400 Cs, and its code is 0. There are 300 Gs, and its code is 10. There are 200 T's, and its code is 111, and there are 100 A's, and its code is 110. I got those by actually doing the Hamming tree thing, so you could do that as well, but we're not going to do that now. So now the question is, this whole sequence, how many bits long is it to represent it using this code? So I had something like this in the lecture. You could figure it out from first principles. go out to 2 minutes, another 15 seconds. Three, two, one, stop it. All right, so this, for me anyway, I don't know if you've had this experience, but this problem reminded me of those ones, the logic gate ones that I asked on the midterm, where, oh, this kind of gate uses this number of ands, and this number of ors, and this number of nots, and this kind of gate does that, and how many gates are there altogether? So, most of the information in this question is completely irrelevant. All that matters is we've got 400 C's, each of which is one bit. We've got 300 G's, each of which is two bits. We've got 200 T's, each of which is three bits. And we've got 100 A's, each of which is three bits. So how many bits is that all together? It's 400 times 1 plus 300 times 2 plus 200 times 3 plus 100 times 3. For a total of 1900, which was choice C. So mostly, you just have to know what to ignore. Okay? Anything not clear after the explanation? You all right with that? All right. All right, one more of these. I asked a couple of these last time, but just want to keep it fresh in your head and give you another chance in case you have questions about it. So this question, we're defining a subroutine called L, which takes as input something we'll call it X. And as long as the current value of X is smaller than 10, it prints X and then makes X 1 bigger. X equals X plus 1, right? Take X, add 1 to it, and store it back in X. At which point it then repeats the while loop. And this while loop will continue until X, if X gets bigger than 10, it will stop. And the question is, for what initial values of X is this actually going to stop? All of them, just ones that are initially less than 10, only when X starts off at 10, as long as X starts off bigger than 10, or no matter what, it's just going to keep looping forever and never stop. Stop at 1 minute. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. All right. Now, before I go through any explanation, does anybody have a question? Or maybe here, maybe I'll do this. I'll pop up the histogram. Okay. Now, does anybody have a question? Let me pop up the histogram again and explain why it is that I would think that there might be a question. At this point, maybe we don't know what the right answer is, but we do know that at least if it were D, then still half the people in the class didn't put that. So you can't all be confident that you got the right answer. So what can I clarify? What can I say that would make it clearer? Not sure. Thank you.
You're welcome. So,
are
you
saying,
well, X, is that supposed to be less than or equal to?
Oh, sorry, that is how you write less than or equal to when you don't have a keyboard that actually does. I did say it in words, too, but yes, if you're not previously exposed to it, this is kind of the way you type. Is that the only question? What's the answer? The answer? The answer is A. So it's not even the majority answer in this case. Why is the answer A? Well, this loop is going to continue on as long as x is too small, and where too small is defined as less than or equal to 10. But while the loop is running, x gets bigger. Right? X, we're going to keep adding 1 to x. Eventually, it's not going to be too small. No matter, even if you give it negative 10,000, eventually it's going to get up to 0 and then up to 10, and then it's going to stop. So no matter what value of x we give it to start, it will eventually stop. It will eventually get to be something bigger than 10. Does that make it sound easier? Is there anything else I can clarify? Yeah, go ahead. Why it would be A. So so halting means that it stops. Stopping means that the loop doesn't go on anymore. This loop continues as long as the current value of x is smaller than or equal to 10. As long as it is, it prints out that number, and then it makes it one bigger. So if the number starts out as 0, then what's going to happen here is it's going to print 0, and then it's going to add 1 to it. It'll be 1, and then 2, and then 3, and then 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Then x is 10, this loop is still going to continue, it's going to print 10, then x is going to become 11, 11 is no longer less than or equal to 10, so this loop stops.
Yeah, so it's greater than 10.
No, no, no. L of x, we're talking about the initial value of x here. When x starts out at some value, and then eventually, it'll stop. And the question is, what starting values will cause it to eventually stop? In this case, it would be any of them, because eventually they'll be bigger than 10. Yeah, so it only stops once x reaches 10. But the question is, for what we call L of x with some number, it's going to loop around for a while and then stop. The number that we called it with, which ones of those are going to cause it to stop? I'm glad you said that, though, because I think that's the most common interpretation or misinterpretation of the question. Right? It's like, well, it's obviously it stops when x is bigger than 10. So then, that's right, and that's why most people put D. That makes perfect sense. But that's not what the question was asking. The question is asking, for what initial values of x will it eventually cause this to become true and stop? Okay? So it's the will eventually that you have to keep in mind. All right? All right. All right, so yes, go ahead.
I forgot to ask, maybe you didn't ask
this one? Oh, okay.
Yeah, what are the 1, 2, 3, 3? I know that's what you multiply by.
This is the code. This is the 1-bit code, 2-bit code, 3-bit code, 3-bit code. All right, so that's how many bits. We're counting up the number of coefficients. All right, very good. So the topic today is parallel computation. This is chapter 7 in Hillis's book. It's a fun topic. There's not much that I want you to get out of it in terms of something that you'd like to be able to do, but I just kind of wanted to expose you to it. It's a neat idea. So here's the motivation. The more we do with computers, the faster we'd like them to be. Every couple years, it seems like we get a faster computer, and it never feels like we're done with that. Faster computers, the faster we make it, the cooler the games get, the better we can communicate at long distances. All sorts of cool things happen as the computers get faster. And computer engineers have been working their butts off for the last 60 years to always try to make their computers run faster. They come up with better and better, actually mostly ways of making things smaller. The smaller it is, the faster light moves through the, or not light, but electricity moves through the wires, the faster the computations get done. There's a well-known law, and this is law more or less in quotes, called Moore's Law, that basically says computer power doubles every 18 months, and that actually starting back in 1959 until now. So if you, well, this plot actually goes from the 1970s, but along this plot are the names of different computer chips. And the question is, how many logical operations, how many cycles can they do in a second? Or actually, in this case, it's plotting how many transistors can you actually put on a chip? So those things are pretty closely related. And what we're finding here, this is on a log plot, right? So this is 1,000 transistors, 10,000, 100,000, 1,000,000, 10,000,000, 100,000,000, 1,000,000,000. And every couple years, it seems like we go up quite a bit. This is taking us out to the Itanium 2, which I don't think I even ever heard of. This is maybe a slightly old plot. They thought this was going to be their next big chip. But nevertheless, they keep each year, each couple of years, they're coming out with something that's faster and faster still. These are all Intel processors. Gordon Moore, I think was his name, was an engineer at Intel who first noticed that this was happening. And ever since then, the engineers actually, what they do is they draw this plot out into the future, and then they say, 5 years from now, we're going to need something that's going to be at least this fast. What technology is going to be able to do that? And then they focus on that to make sure that it happens. So this is a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? One of the reasons that they've stayed on this curve is because they're using this curve as a roadmap to decide how fast to make things, or how hard to try to make things that fast. Now, there's a lot of reasons to believe that this doubling can't go on forever. At some point, computers are going to reach a maximum speed. Currently, it takes about a nanosecond for it to do one cycle through the processor. Information travels at about the speed of light, 1 foot per nanosecond. Smaller chips get you shorter cycle times. But once you get so tiny, tiny, tiny small, then quantum randomness actually starts to mess things up. And so as far as we can tell, maybe by 2010, 2020, no one's going to have a way of making computers any faster, or make cycle times any faster than they'll get to be at that time. So how we get, but we're going to still want faster computers. So one way of getting faster and faster computers is to use more, not necessarily faster computers, to do the same work. So many hands make light work, right? If you're trying to get a lot done, sometimes it's helpful to bring a lot of your friends along with you, and the group of you can get things done faster than a single person can. So this is a very nice idea, but it does get kind of tricky to get it to work. So what I'd like to do is give you some sense of the promise of parallel computing, this idea of getting multiple computers to work on the problem together. Also, what some of the difficulties are, and some of the ways that we can kind of get around it. So I found this picture on the web. I liked it for a whole bunch of different reasons. One is that this machine in the background looks very cool. This is a computer that was available in 1989. It had 65,000 processor units on it. It's basically like 65,000 computers in one big black cube. This computer was designed by Danny Hillis, the guy who wrote the book that we're reading. So I thought that was kind of cute. And that's part of the reason that he has a chapter on parallelism, because this is something that was near and dear to his heart. In his PhD thesis, he described how to build a computer like this. And he graduated, got his PhD, and went, as far as I can tell, across Massachusetts Avenue to the other side of Massachusetts Avenue and started a company where they actually ended up building and selling a bunch of these things. You might notice that there's not a lot of them around anymore. The company has gone defunct for various reasons. But here's one of the reasons. One of the reasons is this. So this gentleman here created a program that won him the Gordon Bell Prize for Supercomputing. He managed to get the 65,000 processor computer to do fluid dynamic simulations, how does water or waves move around. And the computer was doing 3.1 billion operations per second. Every second, it was doing 3.1 billion operations. That's very impressive. And certainly for 1989, it was extremely impressive. But look what we've got, now. The current as of last spring, Mac G5, that 17 years after this, that means that computer speed has doubled about 11 times, which means computers are about 2,000 times faster. Individual computers are 2,000 times faster than they were back then. So you can basically get 2.5 billion cycles per second on a computer that you could buy at the Short Hills Mall, right? So getting this amount of power is no longer a big deal. You can just go and pick it up. So that's kind of freaky in a way, right? I mean, this guy won a big award at the time for doing something that was interesting and hard, but now he would have a much easier time doing it now than he did 70 years ago. So that's sort of interesting. One of the reasons that this didn't continue this way is because the individual processors on this computer were really slow and really dumb, but there are a lot of them, and so sometimes that was enough. But usually you'd rather have a faster processor. So here's an example of what people are doing with supercomputers now, or these parallel computers now. Google. In what sense? Well, Google won't tell anyone how many computers they have. But I went to a talk where somebody said, look, we know how much money they have, we know how much they've spent on things, we know how much computers cost, we know how much it costs to have the people and the buildings that they've got. So probably they've dumped this amount of money into computers. So if you think about that, you estimate that they have approximately about 300,000 computers, at least at the time that they had their IPO. Maybe it's 100,000. But still, we're talking about 100,000 computers that are of the speeds that we have now, whereas the connection machine had only 65,000 processors that were really tiny and very, very simple. So the the largest amount of compute power that's probably ever existed in the history of our planet is owned by Google. And they're doing it, you know, to search for Scarchel, as far as I can tell, is the main purpose. So they've got 100,000 of these extremely powerful computers, but they're doing pretty remarkable things with them. So, all right, so let me, to put things into perspective a little bit, there's a book written by a computer scientist called The Mythical Man Month. The Mythical Man Month, I'll tell you the Mythical Man Month story in my own way. So more computers, that means we can do things faster, right? It depends what you're doing. So just as a thought experiment, consider that you know, J.K. Rowling took about 2 years to write the latest Harry Potter book. Took her about 2 years to write. The publisher wasn't happy with that. The publisher wanted the book now, right? So couldn't they have just hired 600 authors, and then they could have gotten the book written in one day, right? So the total number of people hours spent, right? 600 authors writing for one day is the same amount of writing time as one author writing for 2 years. So, you know, balances, so we should be able to get books arbitrarily fast. And of course, that's just nonsense, right? This is the mythical mammoth. The idea of multiplying the number of people working on a project times the amount of time they spend on it, that does not give you an accurate measure of the amount of productive work that you can accomplish. So you can't just divide a task or a computation of length n by the number of people working on it or computer processors working on it to get the completion time. Why? Because you got to coordinate. It's got to be the case that all these authors, they can't just each write like six pages. The pages all have to kind of fit together and make sense. And so they need to talk to each other. And so it's not just the work time. It's the work time plus the coordination time, the communication time. And this, you know, this bites publishers like Scholastic, but it bites computer programs as well. You have to somehow come up with a way of making the tasks not require a lot of communication or keeping the communication to a minimum. So here's another thought experiment. Imagine that we've got, imagine we needed to build a wall along the southern border of our country. But now let's imagine we've got a long fence and then we want to paint it. This is the Huckleberry Finn version of the problem. How can we break up this task among multiple workers? So painting a fence involves the following steps. You got to open the paint cans, you got to prep the surfaces so that the paint will stick to them, I guess. I don't do a lot of painting. You actually have to apply the paint, and then you have to clean the brushes when you're done, otherwise you have what we have in our garage, which is a bunch of white, crusty, formerly paintbrushes. So you might think, oh, great, well, we can break this up. We'll have the first person do the first step, we'll have the second person do the second step, we'll have the third person do the third step, and we'll have the fourth person do the fourth step, and we'll get it done in a quarter of the time. You think? Because while the person's opening the paint cans, the person who would be cleaning the brushes, what's that person doing?
Nothing.
Sitting on his or her hands, waiting for the rest of the steps to finish. And by the time this person's ready to do the cleaning of the brushes, the opening the paint cans person is now sitting and doing nothing. So basically, there's one person busy during this step, and one person busy during this step, and one person busy during this step, and one person busy during this step. And so you really could have done the same task with just one person. Having the four people doing it, in this case, there's no advantage to it. All right, so how am I being stupid? I mean, that's not a good way to do it. Do we give up, or is there a way? If we've got a big pile of people, we've got a long length of fence, how should we solve this problem? So we shouldn't assign people to the steps, because there's no win to that. There's no advantage. Everybody's sitting and waiting. So how should we use the people? Presumably, you could actually solve this problem if I gave you a fence and the rest of the class, you would find productive things for us to do. So, three people will listen to their iPods, two people will go to the vending machine because we'll need sustenance later. No, come on. I mean, if we're painting the fence, surely you've been in this situation. Clean up after a party, right? Do you have...
Everybody works on the same step.
But if they're all working on the same, like literally doing exactly the same thing at the same time, that wouldn't help anything. They need to be working on different cars?
Parts. Like half of them do the first initial steps and then they switch over when it's time to clean the brushes and stuff like that.
Could do that. I think you were closer. Everyone could be doing the same step at the same time, but they need to be working on something that's different. What's different?
Can all the people do the first half of the steps, you understand, like, there's four people.
But if they're all painting the same, like, slat of the fence, then they're all going to be in each other's way, right? I'm saying, I'm being purposely stupid about this, right? I think you have something in mind, I just want you to make it explicit. It's a long fence. One half of what?
The fence.
One half of the fence. I guess that's sort of what I was thinking. I was figuring, you know, these fences come in kind of segments, right? And so you put each person on a segment of the fence, right? You take the length of the fence and you divide by the number of people you have and you give them, you know, one end of the fence, right? So that's the parts and that's the, everyone doing the same thing but at different parts of the fence, yeah? Okay, right. So obviously everybody's got their own paintbrushes and cans and so forth. They've got their own segment of fence. They go and they paint one segment of fence and at the time that person's done, the whole fence is painted. Right, because everyone's doing it all at the same time in parallel. So that's the right way of breaking up this particular problem. We give everybody a can, a sander, a section of fence, and clean materials. Everyone executes all four steps of their own part of the fence. And so this shows you there's really two different kinds of parallelism that you need to think about. One is instruction parallelism, where different people are doing different things at the same time. And then there's the fence painting idea, which is more data parallelism. Everybody's doing the same things, but they're doing it on different data. They're doing it in different parts of the world. And certainly fence painting, this is a good match. The computer that Telus designed was only for this kind of parallelism. All 65,000 processors were all doing the same thing at the same time, but they were doing it on different data. So you can tell all the processors, all right, everybody, take the first number in your list and add it to the second number in your list. Everybody's got their own numbers, but everyone's doing adding at the same time. And so they called it SIMD, a single instruction, multiple data. Whereas this other kind is sometimes known as MIMD, where you've got separate computers possibly doing different things, multiple instructions, multiple data. And Hillis, at least in his book where he described the connection machine, specifically said, data parallelism is the only way things are going to scale. However, the way things really seem to be turning out is that he was wrong. Mostly, people are using instruction-level parallelism in the sense that we've all got our own computers doing their own things at the same time. But nevertheless, interesting distinction. All right, so we're going to try to do something and see if we can do it fast as a group. So everybody, think of your telephone number. If you've got multiple telephone numbers, just whichever one comes into your mind first. And think whether or not there's a 5 in that number. And then if there is, raise your hand. All right, so the answer is yes, there's at least one person in the room who has a telephone number with a 5 in it. Think of how fast we did that compared to what I would have to do if I went to each person individually. You, yes, no, you, yes, no, you, yes, no, until I finally get somebody that the answer is yes. Let's try another one. Do you have 2 5s in your telephone number? If you do, put your hand up. All right, we got it. At least 3. Nice. Very good. All right, so because of optics, right? I can actually look at you all more or less at the same time and see whether the hand goes up. I don't have to consciously kind of look at each person individually. So this operation can happen very, very quickly because each of you individually is deciding yes or no, and then in the blink of an eye, or the raise of a hand, I can determine whether or not anybody has the answer yet. Oh, anybody have any 3 5s? Spell tell number that has 3 5s in it at the same time. If you're on TV, you would, because the first 3 digits would be 5s. 555-1726. No 3. All right, so then we got to know. And again, faster than if I had to go through the whole list and determine that. So I don't want to get too deep into this, but Python does give you kind of a way of asking this question in a way that looks parallel, could be implemented in parallel. The sequential approach says that we've got a list of people in the class, a list of telephone numbers, and then we loop through each one to see if it has enough 5s in it. So it would look like this. Define a subroutine check all for each telephone number in the list. If that telephone number has enough 5s, then we say yes. Otherwise, we keep going through this list until we've exhausted all the telephone numbers. And if none of them return true, then we say no, nobody's got that number of 5s. On the other hand, really what we're doing is something more like this. The way we did it in the class is everybody separately executed, do you have enough 5s on their own data? And then we did what's called a reduction, where I took the summary answer from everyone and turned it into a single value, yes or no, in the case of 3 5s. So if we had separate processes, like separate people, everybody checks one number, we collect the results. It turns out you can do this in logarithmic time if you have n processors. And so it's essentially, the whole thing's done pretty much in constant time, log time. So even though this is kind of a silly, very small example, it turns out that the two most significant data parallel operations that one would need to know about are the two that we just talked about. One is map, which basically says, I need to tell everybody what to do. I need to give out the instructions, and you apply it to your own data. And then there's reduce. So basically, I give out the problems, you guys compute your answers, and then I reduce them down to a single number, that's the reduction step that summarizes the results. So in the case of, does anybody have 3 fives, I was basically doing an or, right? Everybody was saying yes or no, and I said yes if anybody, this person or that person or that person, so that would be an or. So giving out information and then pulling it back in, those are the two fundamental operations for doing a big parallel computation. So here's what's neat. So this was known, so I actually worked at Hillis's company in 88, I guess. And I loved working with this kind of stuff, and I loved thinking about problems this way. It was a lot of fun. But then it kind of fell out of fashion for many, many years. And then Google, somebody at Google rediscovered it. And they called it MapReduce. And what they did is they actually implemented this idea on a massive scale. All the Google computers can respond to MapReduce operations. So what this allows them to do is automatically break up data across lots and lots of computers, execute the map function on the machines in parallel, and then combine the results together using a reduction. Separate combining parser. So they actually have this implemented. It runs on the Google machines, and they use it for all sorts of things. So here's one concrete example. So they get about 2 million queries a day, or multiply that times 7 to get how many queries in a week, like 14 million queries in a week. And one of the things they do just on the side, just to get attention, is they announce to the world, here are the 10 most popular queries this week. The way they do that is they take these 14 million queries, all the queries that they got over a 2 week period, and they farm them out to a bunch of different computers. They do a map reduce to figure out which ones are the most common. They get the information back, and then it just reports the list. This is actually a very complicated, difficult, time-consuming operation that goes really fast because they know how to use multiple computers to solve it in parallel. And just for yachts, this is the list that comes up, I guess, for last week. The number one most common query is either Michael Richards or Kramer. Presumably people have heard about this. I just learned about it yesterday.
Did you hear about the Kramer thing?
That's, yeah, I just learned about that. So that's pretty remarkable. Now it's on the cover of Newsweek, too, so I guess I'll get another take on it. The second most popular query was some combination of either Black Friday or Black Friday deals, Black Friday sales. What was that about? Well, Black Friday being the day after Thanksgiving, people were thinking about going shopping, I guess. Thanksgiving was the third highest query. Circuit City made it to the top 5, along with Best Buy. I guess they had good sales. Did anybody go to either of these places on Black Friday? Yeah?
No, but I
was it crazy?
I heard people were paying $2,000 just to get a better chance in line in Circuit City.
In Union, it went around.
Was that what was going on?
I stayed in my bedroom.
Yeah, there was a riot. There was like police.
A riot?
Yeah, they had like. Holy
crap!
They had the fire department in there.
My dad went and decided that it wasn't worth waiting 3 hours online to get a 1 gig flash drive for $3.
So they had some kind of sick sale? Is that what happened?
That's what all the places do that.
Just to lather us up and make us insane.
They have like three.
I heard about PlayStation 3s, yeah.
They only had
a
couple hundred of them or something.
Yeah, so basically, you know, people, yeah, like guns and knives.
Holy. Why is PS3 not?
All right, so yes, that's a good question. So then the Wii came up. So that's the Nintendo, the latest Nintendo machine that just came out. For me, because, you know, I got to cook something. Kelly Ripa, I think she was also involved in a bit of a blow up, right? Now if people didn't hear, so she did something on air that a lot of people interpreted as being homophobic, and so she took a lot of flack about that.
Oh yeah, I heard about that.
Who is that?
Kelly Ripa is the co-host with Regis on the Regis and Kathy Lee. It's not called that anymore.
She
didn't want somebody to touch her face. He was a guy who was on.
She has kids though.
What's his name?
Clay.
Clay Aiken, right? So Clay Aiken went to touch her on the face, and she said, "Don't do that. I don't know where your hand's been." And it just all went from there.
And then Rosie O'Donnell
tore her another one for that. Anyway, so immediately after Kelly Ripa, green bean casserole, American Music Awards. Did that just happen?
Yeah.
All right. So anyway, so these are the searches that were gaining in popularity over the course of November 25th, 2006. And the only way they could have done this, considering the tremendous amount of data that they've got, is by doing this parallel MapReduce idea. It's really just an excuse to talk about Kelly Ripa, right? The actual index, remember we talked about how Google searches for things, they take all the words that appear anywhere on the web and they sort them so that they can very quickly determine whether a word that you search for is somewhere in their list. That process of creating a giant index, like the big index in the back of the web, right? Got the web, and then the end there's the index, is 20 terabytes, 20,000 gigabytes of data. To actually compute the index off of this is incredibly difficult and expensive. They actually do it with MapReduce. It takes them about 5 to 10 MapReduce operations where they farm the data out to a bunch of computers. They all do their own little mini sorts. They gather some of the data back out. They re-farm it out. This kind of washes over about 10 times. And at the end of that, they now have an index that they can use to do fast searches. Because of the way they implemented it, it handles machine reliability issues. Like, they have so many computers that there's always a computer that's about to fail, and it just dies. And if that stopped them from doing their computations, they wouldn't be who they are now. So they actually, the whole MapReduce thing, will notice if one of the computers has gone away, and it'll just, you know, shun it, it'll just ignore it, work around it. But the individual programmers don't have to worry about that. It's all handled at the lower level. It's like an autonomic nervous system for this big network of computers. All right, so let's you know, can I have 5 minutes? 5 minutes. All right, so let me see what else I wanted to get. I was hoping to have time to get everybody to come up here, and we were going to do a parallel sort where everyone would actually be a part of the list that was being sorted. But I don't think we have time for that. Let me see if I can do one interactive demo like this. All right, here's what I'd like you to do. How do we get reduced to be fast? In the case of everybody just raising a hand just to do an OR, that wasn't so bad. But if we have a more complicated operation, so here's the complicated operation. Remember before you were thinking about your telephone number. Think about the first digit of that telephone number. I would like to know the sum of all the first digits of all everyone's phone numbers. Okay? So each of you has one of those. I could just ask you one at a time, write them down, and I can add them myself. But I'd like to do it faster. I'd like to take advantage of the fact that you guys know how to add. Unfortunately, you don't know each other's phone number, so you can't just do all the adding for me. So here's how we're going to do it. We're going to do this in parallel. Think of your number and raise your hand. So everybody put your hand up once you have just a number in your head. Think of your phone number, just the first digit of your phone number, then put up your hand. Okay, good. All right. No, don't add anything, because all you've got one digit, and we're going to add all those one digits together. All right, so I want you to find someone, if you have your hand up, find someone else whose hand is up and pair up. Now, some people might not be able to find a pair, just don't worry about that. But if you can find someone to pair up with, tell each other your number, add them up, and one person put your hand down. So you're taking the other person's number, or you're giving your number to the other person.
Only one of us
puts their hand up. Only one of you needs to keep the sum of the two and keep your hand up.
You want the sum or the hand down?
All right, so wait. If you, the person with the sum is the person with the hand up. This would go a lot faster the second time, I assure you. All right, so now about half the people should have their hands up. And each of those persons should have the sum of two digits, one your own and one of someone else's. All right, repeat this operation. Find someone else whose hand is up, exchange numbers, get the sum, and one hand goes down. If you can't find someone, you're going to have to just stay your hand up.
23.
All right, good. You keep your hand. You can add. Keep your hand up. All right. All right, so now we should be down to a quarter of the class. Keep your hand nice and high so that other people can see you from a distance now. All right? Now pair up, you guys. Wait, no, you guys with the head.
27.
Yeah, you guys add your, oh, I didn't see you back there. Is there five people whose hands up or six?
It's like five.
All right, so you just hang loose. We'll get to you in a moment.
23. 28. 23 and 28. 51.
All right, you got the 51. Did you have yours? Wait, don't tell me. I don't need to know yet. All right, you guys pair up and sum?
64.
All right, you guys pair up and sum?
I got 64.
Oh, 60, 50.
64 and 50
It's
114.
In record time. All right. And by record, I mean the slowest possible way of adding however many numbers up. Okay. So, what do I want? What did I want you to glean from this? All right. One thing is that this really should be the total of everybody's numbers, right? Because each time your hand went down, your total went to someone else. And it just kept accreting that way. The other thing is, yeah, you know, modulo arithmetic error. How many rounds, each round should take about the same amount of time. How many rounds do we do? The first hand, everyone's hands up. The second round, only half the people. The third round, half of that, until we have just one hand up at the end. Thank you. How many rounds is that? As a function of n. If we had n people, if we keep halving the number of people whose hands are up, then how many rounds until we get down to just one person? In this case, it took us like four or five rounds, but as a function of n, if we had a million people, it would take longer, but it wouldn't take that much longer. I mean, anybody? Throw it, give me a, what's my favorite function of n?
Log.
Log, thank you. Appreciate that. Log, after log n rounds, it works sometimes. We're done with this. So if we've got a million people, it's still only like eight rounds of this adding up before we get the answer that we want. It's really fast. The last bit is, how do they make queries fast in Google? They search billions of web pages in less than a second. What they do is they actually split the index up on over thousands of computers. So the basic idea is we're going to send the same query to a whole bunch of different computers. They're all going to compute their little piece of the answer. They get sent back to the front, and it's what's called embarrassingly parallel. That is to say, they don't need to talk to each other. They only need to talk to whoever asked the question, and they can solve the problem that way. So usually when you search in Google, it actually probably involves maybe half a dozen different computers, or possibly even more, half a dozen deep of computers to actually get the answer to your query. There's other things that go well in parallel. You can do sorting. But only certain things, just we don't know how to make them go fast in parallel. So it really helps to have the right problem if you're going to try to make it go really, really fast. When in video games, one of the ways that they make video games animate lots of stuff really fast now is they break it up. They actually have separate processors handling different parts of the world, of the simulated world, and each one is kind of computing what's happening in that part of the world. Then they all get combined together and displayed on the screen.
So that's the PS3.
The PS3 does it really well. I'm told that it's really quite something to see. And yeah, PS3 has tons of these little chips, actually more than anybody else had been doing in the past.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing.
That's
is that why someone was shot for one?
I think so. Parallelism is really dangerous. Kevlar. I'm just going to say Kevlar. Just leave it at that. All right. Thanks a lot. I will see you next time. Oh, I did release a homework that you should see on the email. Last one.